The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Hey, welcome to another edition of the Filthy FRB Show. Of course, I'm FRB and joined as always by Filthy Tom Lawler. What's up, Tom?
Not too much. I'm excited, Brian. We got a great guest today.
Yeah, we do. We have Nick Wazdowski from North Carolina State. He is the two-time defending NCAA heavyweight national champion. He's got one more year of eligibility to go. What's going on, Nick?
Not much, Brian and Tom. Just relaxing, hanging out here.
Now, I was looking through the history of the NCAA heavyweight tournament, at least since like the 60s, and I saw only two guys who have ever won three national championships. One was the guy Carlton Hasselrig that played for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And yep. Jimmy Jackson from Oklahoma State. I think he passed away a few years ago.
Possibly. I've only heard of Carlton, but maybe Jimmy Johnson too, is that what we said, or whatever, Jimmy Jackson.
And I was like, oh, is that the guy that played basketball for Ohio State in the Dallas Mavericks? But no, it was a different guy.
I thought you were talking about the former Miami Dolphins coach.
Was that the guy's name?
Oh, that's Jimmy Johnson.
Oh, Jimmy Johnson, the Dallas Cowboys guy.
Yeah. It's not many. I wanted to, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean that kind of flows into my next question, because I was talking with Chael Sonnen last night, to get some, because he knows so much more about wrestling than I do. Just kind of get some questions for you. And the first thing that he was like, well, how about the Olympic red shirt? Is that something you're doing? Because in wrestling, from what I understand, you're allowed to take a regular red shirt, and then you're allowed to take an Olympic red shirt. So you get 6 years and but 4 years of actual competition.
Yeah, me and my coaches haven't really talked about it. I don't think it's something I would go through with. I think just going through the college year, I'll be in pretty good shape, and I'll be ready to compete at the trials next year. But I'm ready. I kind of want to graduate college and get done with it all. So.
Sure. So, of course, in late March, you won your second NCAA title. You beat Adam Kuhn from Michigan, who's actually your last loss, and then you reeled off 55 in a row. And then you competed at the U.S. Open. You came in fourth. It's got to be difficult, because the college season, you're just doing the folk style, and then you got to transition, train a few weeks to go to the Open. Was that, do you think you maybe didn't wrestle up to your full potential?
I think I wrestled pretty well there. I only lost to Tervell 8-2, and he's one of the best guys in the world. I'm out in Columbus, Ohio right now. I'm actually training with him. And But I think I wrestled pretty well there. I wasn't as motivated as I probably should have been. I was kind of just out there wrestling. I think I did pretty well. But I'm a little more motivated and excited for the World Team Trials. Worked a little bit more, so... I'm not disappointed with it, but at the same time, I'll be a lot more ready for the trial.
What do you got, Tom?
Yeah, well, as far as the U.S. Open goes, Nick, who are some guys? Turville's not, he's not like too long in the tooth, but he's been around for a little while. Who do you see as some other top up and coming guys at heavyweight? That could give us some problems in the future.
Well, there's guys. There's still guys in the weight class. I've wrestled 2-3 times I haven't beaten yet, like Zach Ray and Tyrell Fortune, two guys that are, they're probably 3 years older than me, 2 or 3 years. And, they're out a little bit longer in their careers. And, those guys they got to knock off to eventually get to the top spot there. So those are tough guys the U.S. has in weight. So we got a good depth, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and at the World Team Trials, as far as I know, it looks like there's only 7 guys who are qualified. And so
yeah.
Those guys being, of course, Tervell, Zach Ray, Dom Bradley, yourself, Tyrell Fortune, Connor Medbury from Wisconsin, and then the wild card was Adam Kuhn, your nemesis, or a guy that you're really building a pretty good rivalry with. So what do you think of the smaller pool of athletes competing for that world team spot rather than, you know, before they used to allow a lot more guys compete.
Yeah, it used to be, I think it used to be like 12 people get in or something like that. But or that was last year because I got in because I was NCAA champ last year and that's how I qualified. But it's only going to be six guys in the mini tournament. So, you know, you're going right off the bat. You either start in the quarters or in the semifinals, depending where you're seated. So you got to be ready to wrestle. And there's no, like, warm-up match. You got to be ready right off the rip. And it kind of makes sense. Where, like, for Bruce Burnett, the national team coach, like, he's trying to find the best guy in the country. And he's not worried about who the sixth best guy at the World Team Trials is. He needs to find a number one guy to bring to the World Championship. So that aspect, it makes sense to why they cut it down a little bit. But, you know, at the same time, you only got to win four matches and you're on the World Team. So it's not too many matches, but they're all tough.
Really tough. I mean, Tom, the thing that stood out to me was the guys who didn't even qualify for this thing. Eric Thompson was multiple-time national champion at Grandview, an NAIA school, but he's been training in state college at Penn State. Tony Nelson didn't qualify. Nick beat him in the finals of 2014. But, I mean, Nelson, two-time national champion himself. So just qualifying for this thing is kind of hard.
Yeah. Yeah, that was that kind of forced me to go to the trials or go to the Open because I was like, if I don't go to the Open, there's no guarantee I get a wild card in. So that was why I really got up and went to the Open for that. So,
Nick, do you see this? You said you're up in Ohio currently training in Columbus. That's at the, I believe it's the Ohio Training Center. Is that the name of it? Or is it
Regional Training Center, the Ohio Regional Training Center.
Yeah, is that is that going to be like a permanent move for you when you're outside of the folk style competition season? Is that going to be something that you're looking to, you know, build upon in the future up in Columbus? Or, you know, are there other opportunities that you're looking to take your skills to the next level when it comes to freestyle?
I'm not really sure what my plans are yet. I have a pretty good relationship with the people up here. I've been coming up here for a couple of years now. But as for post-college, I'm going to hope to try to stay around NC State if things work out around there. Before I get into coaching, I think I'd like to just compete for a couple of years, 4 or 5 years, before I really look to get into coaching at all. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned coaching. I mean, because you're going to have no absence of options after you're done at North Carolina State. You know, I even saw that you were all-academic team at ACC, which is impressive because, I mean, the wrestlers are not known to be the smartest guys, at least the, you know. But, yeah, I mean, so you have that option. You can do basically anything you want with that degree from North Carolina State. And then, of course, you're going to have an option to go into MMA because, you know, like, for example, Bellator has signed Aaron Pico. They've signed Ed Ruth. And, you know, fast forward 18 months, if they signed a three-time NCAA national champion, that's a big deal. That's a big press release. And then, of course, you also have the option with WWE, which, that's hard to turn down, you know, being a young guy, to turn down the possibility of being this global superstar. So, have you given it much thought, or is it just going to be one of those things that you deal with when it comes?
I've thought about it for sure. I think just at least where I'm at right now, I've done so much within wrestling. I'm at a point where like I'm not too far off of you know making the Olympic team and stuff like that, and no one being able to say you've done that is a real accomplishment or win a medal at the Olympic Games, so stuff like that. Would be kind of why I would stay in wrestling for a while. And you look at guys like Daniel Cormier that maybe he didn't want to get into coaching and wanted to continue his athletic career and get into MMA. I've done some grappling and stuff. I've trained with a couple guys that fight professionally and stuff like that. So, I'm familiar with it, but not really the striking and stuff like that. I've never really been hit in the jaw at all. So I don't know if I got a good chin at all for that. But like anything else, I think I'm confident enough in my ability that I can pick it up if I, that's something I desire to do. And then for WWE, I don't know. I just kind of I never really thought about doing it. I will watch it on TV and all that stuff. But I don't know if I could do it, like getting on the mic like that and start all the trash talking like those guys do. So.
You know, I mean, just to talk a little bit about the MMA transition, you know, Tom, you've been in the UFC, I think, since 08. And, you know, when you got in, you come from a wrestling background, too. Was it difficult for you to pick up the striking, or was that something that you had already been training before you even, you know, wrestled in college?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, like, it's almost probably the almost exact opposite between, like, the reasons why Nick is wrestling and the reasons why I was. You know, wrestling to me was like a means to an end to get to MMA in the long run, or to get to professional wrestling, where it sounds like, you know, to Nick, this is more of the, you know, more, there's more emphasis on the wrestling itself. So for me, like going into MMA, I already knew about the striking. I was such a big fan beforehand that it wasn't a huge transition. But if you don't have that mindset of going in and saying, you know, I'm going to start from scratch, I'm going to be a blank canvas and, you know, develop these skills, then it's very tough. But obviously anybody who's reached a high level in one sport is going to be able to do so in another a lot easier than anybody else. So, you know, I think obviously if Nick tried to pick up some of these skills, it would probably be very easy for him.
Yeah. And sometimes going in, like you said, as a blank canvas is better than going in with some experience in developing bad habits. So when you walk in there, the coach, he's dealing with somebody who doesn't have any bad habits because he hasn't done it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that brings up a good point. You are true there. Like with the striking stuff, I've actually never hit pads with people, like with a trainer or anything like that. So I don't even know. Like I may have good skills, I'm not sure.
Yeah. You know what's mind blowing is I was having this conversation with a couple guys the other day, and you know, for people out there listening, don't know, I was on season 8 of The Ultimate Fighter, and one of the finalists of that season was a guy named Vinny Magalhaes, who's one of the best jiu-jitsu guys in the world, bar none. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And he was in the finals of that Ultimate Fighter against Ryan Bader. And a couple weeks ago, it came up that, you know, Vinny told me he had never even hit mitts before going on the Ultimate Fighter, which just, you know, baffled me in a lot of ways. You can, I mean, I'm sure, you know, you're going to find guys who can go out there and just get away with, you know, this one skill set. But it's kind of strange to hear somebody that's able to reach such a high level without doing any of the mitt work or striking.
And, you know, Tom, Ryan Bader, I don't think, had done much stand-up training. When he got on that show, wasn't he, like, maybe 3-0 in MMA, like, maybe a year into his training?
Yeah, he was only, I think he'd only been around for a short time. He might have been, like, 6-0. I think maybe he might have been fighting for a year or two. Yeah, but his striking, even if you look at it over the past year or so, is actually a lot better than it was 2 years ago. You know, obviously the guy hits like a fucking Mack truck, but you know.
Yeah, Bader, he was in a NCAA tournament with like Phil Davis and Chris Weidman were in the same bracket, I think. I can't remember what year it was, but there's a picture of them all standing next together, and they all became you know, big stars in MMA. But, you know, Nick, the other thing, you know, you mentioned the WWE, you know, with the Performance Center now, it's one of those things where they're coaching you. You know, they're you know, you can't work it. You can't be totally fake. There has to be an element of truth to it. And I've heard Jim Ross say it a million times, says, you know, your wrestling character is yourself with the volume turned up to 12. You know, it's just an exaggerated version of who you are, really. And at that Performance Center, I've never been there. I hope one day maybe Jerry Briscoe let me in there just to take a look at it. But they have these rooms where you work on your promos, and they have all these producers and coaches that'll help you with it.
Huh? I didn't know about that. That's pretty cool. That's a huge part of the entertainment side of it all.
Yeah. I agree. I can. It's tough to even formulate a thought sometimes. Never mind with a camera on you and millions of people You know, Tom, how did you've done some professional wrestling? Like, what do you do with your promos? Do you just get in front of the mirror and just start freestyling, or?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's the way that they tell you to start start practicing your promos. Get in front of the mirror and do it. To be honest, I mean, I think just a lot of the day as I'm walking around throughout the streets and taking a look at people, in my own mind, I start cutting promos on them. So, you know, it's nothing new.
you're just walking around in Vegas. Well, Vegas is a good place to people watch, and you're cutting promos on them in your head.
In my mind, I'm constantly just, you know, cutting promos on everybody. Everybody that I walk by, everybody that I see, Brian. You don't even want to know what I was thinking about you last week.
We were at UFC 187, and I remember some of it. It was quite a good time. Nick, have you ever been to a UFC event?
I've been lucky enough. I've been to two of them.
Which ones?
A couple years ago in Portland, Oregon. I believe it was Randy Couture versus Nogueira.
Oh, yeah. I was at that one. That was UFC 102.
Yeah, that sounds right, up in Portland, Oregon. And I saw the Hendricks-Lawler in Vegas in December.
Oh, okay, yeah, UFC 181.
Yeah, yep. So I've been to two of them, different seats for sure in both locations, and both were pretty good. I enjoyed them. A lot different than what you see on TV.
Yeah, it is such a different energy level to see it in person. The music is so loud, and I always see people online saying, you know, they're interviewing Rogan. They're like, why is he yelling? He's yelling because the music is deafening. He can't hear himself talk. He doesn't know if he's speaking at the right decibel.
Yeah. And I know when at 181, it wasn't, I don't think that place was definitely not as sold out as it was expected to be, maybe. I didn't think there was as many people as I expected to be in there, at least.
Was that over at Mandalay instead of MGM?
I think so.
Yeah, it's a little bit smaller arena.
Yeah, that was with Melendez and Pettis too, correct?
Yeah, was it Tom Pettis and?
It was
UFC.
It was
181.
Hendricks Lawler, and maybe Melendez and
Anthony Pettis.
Yeah, and he got choked out the first round, I think.
Yeah, Well, Tom's making his return to the UFC after a couple of years away. He hurt his knee, but he's fighting in Chicago on July 25th against a training partner of Chris Weidman's named John. Tom?
Gian Vellante or something?
That's him, yeah.
Hey, how do you know? You know this guy, Nick?
No, I don't know. I saw Zach's fight. It's pretty good, but they're in Long Island guys, so they're New York guys, but I don't know them that well.
Okay,
you're an upstate guy. You're from right outside Schenectady, right?
Yep, right near there. I don't get down to Long Island much, but I still gotta claim them as New York people because they are. So
you sound kind of reluctant there to claim Long Island as part of New York.
Yeah, it's There's some people, but guys like Chris Weidman are pretty good guys. So.
Yeah. I had a very long, probably a 30-minute conversation, and I mean, most of it was just shooting the shit with Vellante backstage at that UFC. But those guys from that camp are always super nice. Matt Serra, Ray Longo, those guys are always, you know, some of the best guys to talk to. Real pleasant guys. So.
Yeah, I've never met those guys, but they all just seem like. Like average Joe's, like you watch the videos with Weidman, and I know a couple people that know him, and he's just like an average guy and just goes about his thing and, you know, helps out when he can and helps around the community and stuff like that. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, Weidman is a good guy, and he went through a lot of things to get to this point. You know, he was in his late 20s, absolutely broke. His wife was essentially bankrolling his entire career. She's a CPA. Living.
Hey, can we talk about this kind of garbage for a second? Because people are talking about the same thing with Cormier, right? That he's broke and was living on welfare. And, you know, to me, people look at it like it's a huge success story. But in a way, I mean, weren't these guys kind of failing themselves at the time? You know, it's one thing to be pursuing your dream while at the same time taking care of all the other responsibilities you have. But I hear, you know, these guys being flat out broke, and you know, I've been there. I've been in the same situation, and looking back, it's really not a healthy way to go through this thing.
Yeah, it's so tough because if you look at Cormier, I mean, he spent so many years chasing that gold medal. I think like he was on the national team maybe 7 or 8 years in a row.
And yeah, at least eight.
Yeah, and he just never made any money. And his manager had called him in 2001 and said, "Hey, do you want to fight?" And he's said, "No, I want to go after that gold medal." And then also he turned down overtures from WWE and then also even TNA when that was, you know, somewhat of a solvent company. But yeah, it's tough, man. Unless you have some financial backing when you get into this, like Johnny Hendricks did, or you know, it's really tough to make this thing work because there's definitely a learning curve to before you make some real money.
Yeah, that's something I've spoken to one of the sponsors at AKA Mark Gross, who owns Oak Grove Technologies.
Yeah, big time sponsor. Ben Askren too, I think they sponsor.
Yep, Askren, Davis, all the AKA guys. He also supports Wolfpack Wrestling Club. He's out of Raleigh.
Oh, okay.
And yep, and that's what he said. He's like, "Man, you want to wrestle, pursue it, because it takes a while in MMA to start making money."
Now, Nick, I could be way off here, but is that Wolfpack Wrestling Club the same one that's headed by Scott Hall and Kevin Nash?
It's a little bit different, but same goals and same mentality.
The pack mentality. I like it.
Yeah.
You know, I was coming back from Las Vegas last week, and at the airport, there was a guy had a shirt on that said "One Man Wolfpack." And I immediately thought of you, Nick. And I was like, "Man, if he ever got into pro wrestling, that would be a good gimmick—the one-man Wolfpack."
Yeah,
I don't know what the shirt. I don't know what the shirt was.
It's from Hangover. It's from the Hangover.
Oh, that's what it's from.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you probably can't use that
gimmick. God, I can't believe for a guy that's hungover as much as you, I can't believe you didn't get the reference.
Well, I didn't see it. I don't watch movies, man.
You may have been drunk when you saw it. You may have forgotten.
Yeah, just like the fights a couple of weeks ago.
I wasn't aware that you didn't watch movies. I'm a big movie hater too. So we need to talk about this off the record sometime.
All right. So you got anything else for Nick Tong?
Yeah. And this is like a serious question. I want to know because you know, I've been recently fighting at 185 for, I guess, the vast majority of my career, the past 6 years or so. But now my next fight's at 205, and I'm weighing about 220, 225, okay? You know, as a heavyweight, you can eat whatever you want, right, Nick?
Yeah.
Are you just slamming sandwiches in the bathroom, hiding from these guys cutting weight on trips, or what?
Not always. Sometimes I feel like being a dickhead, I'll eat right in front of them and stuff like that. But I don't really watch my diet. I think if I maybe this upcoming year, like every year, I gotta change something, make myself better. I may get a little stricter diet, eat cleaner, and stuff like that. Probably improve my performance. But I like right now, I eat whatever I want.
Yeah. Can you run us through a day in the diet
for myself?
Yeah.
All right. We'll say. Maybe this past week when I was back in North Carolina, because during the school year we get a free dinner every day at the student athlete dining hall. Mm-hmm. So there, like, it's all you can eat, but it's pretty healthy stuff for the most part. But I get down 2-3 plates there and a bunch of other stuff. But normally for breakfast I'll just have a cup of coffee, bowl of cereal. It depends what I have in my house. Maybe a bowl of oatmeal. I'm not sure. Lunch during the school year, probably, it depends like the time of day when I'm going to eat, because if I'm getting close to a workout within like an hour and a half, I won't eat that much because that'll slow me down big time in practice. But, if I can, I'll get over Chick-fil-A sometimes. usually about once or twice a week, kind of the second half of the year I was going. And then, or I'll just go home, make sandwiches or something like that. So nothing too extreme. Sometimes later at night, I'll get a little hungry and have to get into something, whatever's around the house, but, pretty consistent when I eat and stuff like that.
Yeah. How many Chipotles are there in Raleigh? Cause that's the number one staple for me.
Yeah, there is one that, all the white girls on campus talking about it. That's like their thing. But I'm not too big on it. I'm not a big burrito Mexican food guy. I'd rather they got this what's it called? A calzone. It's called DP Dough. And I'll order on Tuesday when it's 2 for $10 and get 2 calzones.
College style.
Yeah. What are you weighing, Nick?
I'm about 260 now, 262.
And when your freshman year at Binghamton, you were what, 215, 220?
I was about 225, 230 in the beginning of the year. I was just doing what I normally do, and kind of after November, mid-December, I talked with Pat, my head coach, and he was like, hey, you know, you could be really good, but you gotta get a little bit bigger. And I was like, well, this is what I do. He's like, well, before practice in the morning, you gotta go to the dining hall and eat breakfast. I'm like, come on, that's waking up like another half hour earlier. He's like, well, you know, that's something you need to be a little bit bigger. So, I started doing that, and I was nationals time, I was like 240. And then after that, after that year, I went home for a month, and did nothing. I worked out occasionally, but just a lot of eating and drinking. And, I probably put on 25, 30 pounds.
Now, speaking of which, yeah, you mentioned the drinking, and I have never, I don't think I've ever actually been out in Raleigh, but, I have been to Chapel Hill.
Franklin Street.
Yeah, I've been on top of the hill. And have you ever frequented that area, Nick?
No, I don't. I don't really. I don't have any friends in Chapel Hill because I'm not being from the area or from North Carolina. You know, I don't have like high school friends or people that I've known for a while that go to different schools around the state. So, I hear ECU is pretty wild too, but again, never been.
Gotcha.
Yeah, ECU's got quite a reputation for partying, but it's kind of out there, out in the eastern part of the state, Greenville, North Carolina, not to be confused.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people like say it's like trash and stuff, but I don't know, I may like it if I ever been, so.
Yeah, that sounds like my kind of deal, a trashy place. Yeah, I'm all about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the reason I brought up the top of the hill thing in Chapel Hill was last time I was there. Just a little quick side note here, Brian.
Yes.
Last time I was there, you know, I was pretty drunk. I was having some drinks, and it's about 2 a.m. And there's some guys in a Qdoba. There's a Qdoba that's open.
Oh yeah.
And these guys are making fun of my friend and picking on him. So you know, as soon as one of these guys turned his head away, I took it upon myself to take a bottle of hot sauce and pour it all over his head.
No shit.
Yeah, that didn't go over too well. You know, the 130 pound, you know, guy that I poured the hot sauce on tried to come after me, and actually my friend Big Frank had to hold him back, Brian.
Oh, Frank, really?
Peacekeeper.
Oh wow. Yeah, we're gonna get Nick in trouble talking about drinking and stuff with the sports information department at NC State.
Yeah,
but
hey, my coach is gonna be on me.
So, but hey, does Dave Dorn try to recruit you for the football team?
Nah. People have on Twitter and stuff. Like after one, they're like, "Oh, Dave, you should get this guy. Try to get him to play football." He's never personally contacted me. I wouldn't. I would try it. Like, I don't think I've never played a down of football in my life.
Wow.
So my high school didn't have it, and my town didn't have like a Pop Warner or anything like that. So
your high school didn't have football.
I graduated with like 75 people, so real small town, real small school. So,
yeah, I didn't know that you could be a school in America and not have football. I thought that was like a guarantee.
But, yeah, now where I'm from, there's quite a few that don't have it. Mm-hmm. It'd be tough to fill out a team. We just got football like 2 years ago, but we split it with another school. So
yeah,
no, it's possible right now.
I gotta think, if you wanted to give football a try, you know, I know Mako tried it at Oklahoma State. I don't think he had ever played football. I mean, he was at Blair Academy. He was wrestling all the time. I don't think he ever played football.
Brian, forget Mako. I mean, Nick could be the next Stephen Neal. He'd be making millions and millions of dollars.
That would be it. A world champ and win a couple Super Bowls.
Yeah. If I gave you some advice, as long as you can long snap, if you can long snap, you've got it made.
Yeah, what's that, a couple downs a game?
Yeah, it's like three plays a game. They can't hit you. It's great.
Yeah. I've thought about it. I see other football players working out and stuff. I'm like, oh, I think my strength and my speed are right there with them. But I don't know if I'm tall enough. Like, I don't know if many guys at you know, big-time Division I or NFL are like 6'1".
Well, that guy from Syracuse that was really good for the Colts was a pass rusher around 6 foot. Dwight Freeney, is that his name, Tom?
Is he around 6 foot?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think because you got speed, right? I mean, that's what you use to your advantage on the mat. I mean, you're always wrestling guys. I mean, Adam Kuhn is what, 6'5", 270?
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, I think your quickness might be to your benefit on the football field.
Yeah, I'd have to check that out someday, maybe. One of the people that I went to school with who just got picked up by the Seahawks, I was talking to him at this block party about it, and because he's a defensive tackle, and I was talking about how, like, we were talking about, like, just hand stuff and getting by people. I'm like, and this is all, like, this is all wrestling stuff, like moving hands and like arms, like dragging by and moving your head and stuff like that. And I was like, I might be able to pick this up. I'm not sure. It'd be tough to get by like a 370-pound like offensive tackle. But.
Yeah. Well, you got anything else, Tom?
No, I mean, there's a lot of stuff we could cover, but Brian, you're the expert here, man.
No, I'm learning, man. I'm learning a little bit at a time. I'm going to be out in Madison, so at the trials.
So yeah, that'll be a good one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Obviously, I'm rooting for you. I'm also rooting for John Reeder at the 189-pound division.
Yep.
I think you got your teammate. You work out with Kyle Snyder?
We put some goes in yesterday, put a couple live goes in. And we'll be working out next week. He's tough.
Yeah, he'll at 200. I think that's 213 pounds. He beat Jake Varner, the defending Olympic gold medalist at the Open. That was a pretty big deal. And then of course Burroughs will be back. That's a loaded division, right? With David Taylor and Andrew Howe, and I think Kyle Dake is making his return. Like he was at the regionals. Exactly. But,
Yeah. Been injured a little bit.
Yeah. Well, all right, man. Hey, Nick, good talking to you, man. Thanks for the time.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, man. We'll talk some MMA. Hopefully we'll be talking about your world team berth there in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
All right.
For sure. I appreciate it.
Okay. Be good, man.
Thank you.
Take it easy, guys.
So, Tom, this is our first time talking about UFC 187 since we were out there, or you were there, you live there in Vegas. And one of the things that have come out of it since then has been Vitor Belfort talking about how he separated his shoulder leading up to the fight against Chris Weidman. And that's the reason that he couldn't finish Chris Weidman in a stand-up. What are your thoughts?
God, this is... Vitor Belfort just has the worst luck ever, right? I mean, I think he had dengue fever when he lost to Sakuraba back in Pride. He's had a lot of really really tough things happen to him, both before fights and during fights, that have kind of hindered his career. And, you know, I just hope he can get back on track and, you know, everything works out for him in the future, because, boy, it, you know, he's got bad luck, and it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Consensus, sorry, the slightest bit of sarcasm there.
But well, I'm sure he's a nice guy, but I mean, come on, you get an excuse for every time he loses a fight. I just, you know, eventually it's like the boy who cried wolf. I mean, I'm not even paying attention anymore, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe the reason he couldn't win was because he's the incredibly shrinking man. You know, every time you see him, he's smaller than he was.
Yeah. Did he ever stop to think that maybe these guys were just better than him that night? I mean, maybe Chris Weidman's just really good and had nothing to do with whatever injury or separated shoulder he had.
I guess he doesn't want to tip the cap and give it to him. But, I mean, he did put him over like his when he took him down. But it kind of sounded like he was just putting him over, say, yeah, when he got on the ground, that's when he was good. And, you know, but it was like, I mean, that was a real – I mean, I knew Weidman was tough from the top, but – I mean, did you see the amount of force that he generates when he's on top and he's ground and pounding? I mean, it's just it's scary.
Yeah, and he sliced through Belfort's guard like butter. And, you know, granted, we haven't seen Belfort working on the ground a lot in a lot of his fights. But, I mean, he did finish, the 205 title contender on the ground with a rear naked choke, if I remember correctly. And you know, he's got skills on the ground, so to see Weidman just kind of blow through his guard and pound the crap out of him was impressive for sure. You know, I'm just sick of this whole excuse thing when it comes to Belfort.
Yeah, and I think most people that have been around the sport for a while know the book on Vitor. He is a big-time front runner. First few minutes, he's one of the most dangerous guys, even off his medicine or his gear. He's still incredibly dangerous, and I think he lit up Weidman one time. I read some tweets saying that on TV, though, like if you actually saw it closer, he really didn't hurt him as much. But, I mean, when I was sitting there next to you watching it, I thought Weidman was hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, I'm sure we were screaming the whole time and you know, stomping our feet and clapping because that was a hellacious fight for 3 minutes. And it was a whirlwind. You know, so obviously there was a lot of stuff going on, a lot of action going on in there. And, you know, even just seeing Weidman covering up and eating one or two shots is not something that we're accustomed to seeing. And he's fought some of the best strikers in the division. He's fought Machida. He's fought Anderson Silva. I mean, some of the best strikers in all of MMA, not just in the middleweight division. And, you know, this was definitely, I think, the most danger he's been in for a short period of time. But he, you know, easily weathered the storm, came out with a cut. But, I mean, poured it on when he had to, and he really came out looking great.
Yeah, but, you know, he fought another fight previous to that. I think it was in San Jose. He got kind of lucky. I mean, you were kind of kicking his ass, and then he pulls out this modified guillotine choke out of nowhere, and, you know, it was just bad luck. Well, good luck for him, bad luck for you.
Well, yeah, well, I had dengue fever, separated shoulder, three broken necks, and actually I had four broken legs at the time. So, you know, he's good, but you know, with all those things taken into consideration, I think maybe next time I'll get him.
I think the point I was trying to go into, and then I lost my train of thought, is Vitor is known to be very weak mentally. And I mean, I know that's easy for me to say because I'm not getting locked inside a steel cage, but it seems like when the pressure is on him, he just breaks and then he looks for a way out. Because, you know, like you were saying, how did Weidman get through his guard that quickly? I think mentally he just quits. I mean, not to say that he could win the fight if he didn't quit, but he just sees the writing on the wall and says, no, I want out of here.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible. You know, that does happen with a lot of people, and it's tough to say in their own mindset whether they even realize it or not. Because you do have a lot of fighters who will, you know, you hear them talk before fights or you hear them pump themselves up, and it sounds like, man, this guy's, you know, the most confident guy on the planet. He's got no issues with confidence. But deep down inside, they're just masking the fact that they're, you know, insecure. And, you know, maybe they haven't worked as hard as they know that they should have for the fight. And that kind of gives them a little crutch to fall back on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've seen guys that I know personally that I knew hadn't prepared much. And I see them up there just, you know, saying all kinds of stuff. And I'm thinking that it's 100% just trying to trick themselves into thinking that they're 100% prepared to be in there.
Yeah, and I think that's a major factor that not a lot of people think about when it comes to this whole fighting thing. I think a lot of guys, do that to cover up for the fact that they are insecure or that they haven't put the work in. Because I know just from a personal standpoint, if I busted my ass for months and months and done everything right and done, you know, all the preparation that I need to, it's going to be a lot harder for me to quit when it comes right down to it. You know, when the going gets tough, it's a lot easier to stay in there if you know you've prepared for all these different situations and you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. No matter how hard it is to get there, you know, you can still see it. And I think a lot of people don't put in the work. They don't put in the hours in the gym. They don't put in the time. And when it comes down right down to it, you know, they're happy to take that way out and try to save face.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point, because there are some guys that they get in trouble, but somehow they find something within them to get through it. You know, they weather the storm because, like you said, they know if they can just get through this rough spot, there is light at the end of the tunnel, because they've put themselves, they've simulated the same situation in the practice room.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at the two main fights from this past UFC that we're talking about, I mean, very similar situations. You had Daniel Cormier getting blasted with that huge overhand right by Rumble.
Yeah.
Sent them flying 5 feet face down. You know, he looked like he was getting RKO'd there out of nowhere for a second.
You know, that's interesting. You know, speaking of that fight, I mean, I read that Anthony Johnson's corner was actually saying, "Anthony, don't quit." It was almost like they were screaming at him, like they knew, you know, he's gonna quit.
Yeah, and they were self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, and they were pleading with him, and he was. I'd never seen a guy so happy to lose. You know,
yeah.
I know he got $500,000. I mean, that's good. You know, good for him.
Yeah, that would make me a little bit happier to lose, I think, if I was getting that big payday. But that fight kind of went how I think we were discussing it. And I pretty much said, you know, after the first round, I think Cormier is just going to be able to outwork him. And lo and behold, for once, when it came to predicting a fight, I was right.
Yeah, you were absolutely right. I mean, I had picked Anthony Johnson, but I really didn't feel too confident. I just thought, hey, you know, he's going to be able to fend off a few takedowns and he's going to blast them. And, you know, DC, he's 36 years old, you know, I mean, and was on the international wrestling circuit for almost a decade. You know, maybe his athletic prime is behind him, but I mean, DC just, other than that big right hand that you talked about, made him look really bad. And it reminded me of the way AJ quit against Vitor Belfort. And so it's funny enough that, you know, Vitor, known as the guy who quits, and he basically made AJ quit. I mean, he did have a tough weight cut, you know, that fight. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah, I remember that one in Brazil.
And
AJ had a couple moments early on, but then I think took a kind of a haphazard shot, if I remember correctly, and Belfort ended up taking advantage. I could be wrong a little bit on that, but
yeah, I mean, I remember like it was looking okay for a couple minutes. Anthony Johnson looked, you know, because he physically should be able to handle Vitor and put him on the mat whenever he wanted. But then, you know, he just, I don't know if he ran out of gas. It was partially that, and then, you know, Vitor ended up submitting him. But you know, we touched upon Vitor and Chris now. To talk a little bit about Daniel Cormier, you know, he is now what they're calling the undisputed UFC light heavyweight champion. And, you know, I've been very vocal on Twitter, and I think that's a misnomer. I don't think that's an accurate portrayal of what Daniel Cormier is right now. To me, he's the interim UFC light heavyweight champion. I can't look at a guy and call him the undisputed champion when in the back of my head, I know 5 months ago, John Jones made him cry. Now, I know I'm not defending what John Jones did. I know he did a shitty thing, and he's probably going to do jail time for it. But that doesn't mean he's not the best light heavyweight in the world.
Yeah, I agree. But, I mean, they stripped him of the title. I mean, is the UFC going to go around and parade John Jones as still being the champion or slight Cormier? You know, in this situation. I mean, I know what they're doing. I know why they're doing it.
everybody knows John Jones is the best 205er in the world, bar none. I mean, that's just the way that it is. But from a, you know, a PR standpoint or a media standpoint, they can't go around saying that because they don't know if the guy's ever coming back.
But what about calling DC the interim champion, and then if John has to go away for a while, you make the interim belt the permanent belt, just like they did with Henin Burrell?
Yeah, well, that would be fine. That's fine in theory. But the fact is they already, you know, they already made the decision to strip John of the title. So at that point, you know, you can't have an interim belt if there's no other champion, I don't think. You get the logic behind that. I'm not saying that the UFC should be going around saying that Cormier is the undisputed best 205er on the planet. But, I mean, he is the undisputed UFC champion by default because, you know, the best guy in the world can't compete.
Yeah, and I had some people argue with me and say, well, why aren't you saying the same thing about Robbie Lawler? Is he a paper champion? And my response to that is it's a totally different thing. George St. Pierre walked away from the sport because he didn't want to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. He didn't put his name on the sign-up sheet. The rest of the guys that Robbie Lawler beat to get that belt, they did. The difference is John Jones is not allowed to sign up. So I fail to see the correlation between the welterweight division and the light heavyweight division. Are you thinking the same as me, or do you see some kind of correlation?
No, I mean, they are two completely different scenarios. Obviously, like you said, GSP walked away from the sport. So at that point, you know, regardless of what people think, and here's the other issue is that he had a very close fight with Johnny Hendricks that was very, you know, controversial, and that was his last fight. So a lot of people thought that Hendricks should have been the champion regardless coming off of that. You know, if John Jones and Cormier had a disputed fight and it was a close decision, you know, a split decision or even a close unanimous decision, then I could see where they could go ahead and try to play that angle with Jones gone. But, you know, that wasn't the case. So maybe they could call him the disputed heavyweight champion of the world, or light heavyweight champion.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to be with Jones. It just seems weird. Like, it's been so quiet since all that shit went down. Like, there's no news about, okay, his first hearing will be on this date, and he's going to enter a not guilty. You know, the procedural thing. You always say you're not guilty, right? But
yeah. It might be better if you don't know about the case.
Yeah, I already got
for your own health, your own personal safety.
Yeah, I already got quite a bit
out for you.
Quite a bit of heat for that one. I wonder if there's some things going on behind the scenes. You know, maybe trying to cut a deal. You know, and say, hey, I'll do 3 or 6 months in jail. Can you drop it from a felony? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think the best case scenario for him, honestly, would be even just to do a little bit of time. Because I think it'll rehab him a little bit in the public's eye because of that, you know, the 1 day drug rehab stint that he went through earlier. People obviously don't look at John Jones and go like, oh, this guy's taking this seriously. So perhaps, you know, having him go through a short stint in jail will do wonders for him, when it comes to the public's outlook of him.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's just like in this niche sport or in politics or in pop culture, they love to build somebody up and then they love to tear them down and then they like to build them right back up again. You know, it's almost like, you know, you put them over, you know, maybe life is professional wrestling. You know, sometimes you have to put them over and sometimes you get put over.
Yeah.
I think if Jones, I mean, if he just gets his act together a little bit, I mean, nobody's asking him, you know, to stop drinking. I mean, he should stop doing coke. I mean, if I was a real close friend of his, I'd say, you got to stop doing the coke, man. I mean, it's just not a good gimmick for you.
Stay away from the white girl.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how to take that. I mean, his old lady is a white girl.
You take it however you want.
Yeah. Oh, I gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, man, stay away from the car. What the fuck? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, maybe it would be good for him if technology kind of jumps ahead of itself and gets a self-driving car on the road really quick.
Or can you imagine if somebody made an app to where you can press a button and someone would come pick you up and you would only have to pay them like $5?
Yeah. Hey, that's a good idea. You should get started on that.
You imagine if somebody came up with that?
Hey, how about this? Listen, if anybody out there has a way to get a hold of John Jones, I've met John Jones a few times. Always a nice guy to me. You know, I obviously he's a great fighter. Got no problems with him. If he needs a driver, I'm more than happy to do it for a decent salary.
Exactly. I mean, he could afford to pay you $100,000 a year, sign a confidentiality agreement. You know, anything that you see, you can't repeat. But yeah. you get paid to drive him around. And like you said, John Jones is a nice guy. You know, there's really – I don't know what the guy's thinking. You know, and it's past being a kid. You know, the guy's 27 years old. I mean, that – the kid shit, it was over 5 years ago, you know, youthful indiscretions, whatever that saying is, you know, right. Hopefully he gets his act together. Cause I think he's got at least another 5 year window here where he can just keep beating people up and, you know, maybe legitimately, I know this is thrown out there so many times, but be the best to have ever done this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's arguable at this point that he's the greatest talent that we've had in the sport, but without the longevity, it's going to be tough to say that he's the greatest fighter that we've ever had. And who knows? I mean, this could be a situation where, you know, he does some time or steps away from the sport, comes back and is just as good as he was, maybe better off because he's cleaned himself up, or he could come back and lose some of that fire and, you know, not be as good as we once thought. But, you know, obviously there's no way to tell, and throw all the fighting stuff out the window, you know, like Daniel Cormier said, you know, he needs to get his shit together.
Yeah. And that reminds me that, you know, there was a tweet sent out by Ryan Bader addressed to Daniel Cormier that said, get your shit together. You got a number one contender standing right in front of you. And
that's a genius line, by the way.
Amazing line that, you know, I admire Bader for coming up with that.
Yeah. And you should be kicking yourself that you didn't come up with that.
We actually had an opportunity to talk with Bader a little bit after UFC 187. And I think right after we talked to him, he went into the press conference.
Yeah, it's what it seemed like.
Because the timing's – because I don't think he was in the press conference and then came out and was talking to us. I think it was – he talked to us and then maybe got all pumped up or something. And it's like, I got to go pick a fight with this guy.
Well, you know, I've been trying to get as much info on that as possible because, you know, we did see Bader right before, and I think I saw him. I could have been seeing double at that point because I had a few, I don't even know what kind of beer I was drinking, probably a Bud Light, unfortunately.
It's the only thing they had in there.
Yeah, it was tough. But, to me it looked like, you know, Bader, it is very strange because Bader's standing in the back all by himself. I mean, he's the only guy in there who's not a media member, but then Cormier starts calling him out. So, I mean, in one way, you know, obviously Cormier kind of picked the fight, but what the hell is Bader doing there anyways?
Yeah. I mean, well, I guess he was upset because he called out John Jones and not him. And I mean, it's hard to argue with Bader. I think he, with John Jones being away for a while, Bader is the guy who's next in line.
Yeah. I mean, besides Bader, there's Gustafsson. And I mean, he's coming off that loss to Rumble, so that's really not a super appealing matchup, even though he probably does match up more favorably against Cormier. Gustafsson does than Bader does.
You think so? I mean, because I think Cormier would just pick him up and, like, dump him on his head. I mean, at least Bader has some wrestling base there.
Yeah, but I mean, you also got to deal with – he's got to get inside to do it, which is really the problem with Gustafsson. Is Gustafsson, he moves a lot. He's got good footwork. If Cormier gets inside, obviously he's going to eat him alive. But, you know, Gustafsson's good. He's dangerous. The problem with Gustafsson is that he doesn't necessarily always, like, have the finishing power in these fights, you know. He's not a big-time finisher, and I would be hard-pressed to see him – beat Cormier by decision, but, you know, who knows?
Yeah, and you know, another controversial thing going on right now is this whole back and forth between Ronda Rousey and Betch Kohea, who, before we recorded this, Tom told me the correct way to say her name. I've been calling her Beth. I don't know, no disrespect to her. I just didn't know that B-E-T-H-E is Betch. I didn't know. So I'll give you a quick summary, okay? So Ronda, this is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Ronda said something like, "Betch, our fight will be your come to Jesus moment." Basically saying that, you know, you're going to be humbled and this is going to be, you know, you're never going to be the same after UFC 190 in Rio. So then Betch comes back and says all these things about Ronda, and a lot of the stuff seemed to be taken from the book, you know, like she was smoking pot and drinking, and, you know, she's putting the heat on the gimmick a little bit. And then she mentions something about, Betch says, "I hope Ronda doesn't kill herself after I beat her." And, you know, when I first saw that, I was like, oh, I don't know, is that, does she know that Ronda's father committed suicide when she was a little girl? And, but, so the reason I thought that was because she had known all these little details that were in the book. And Ronda's dad, the history of story of his, of him was also in the book. So I figured that she got it all from the book. Although I don't know.
Okay, well, I saw yesterday on the very reliable Twitter source that Guilherme Cruz, the reporter, said that, I mean, the book's not even available in Brazil.
Well, they don't have books there.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I already used that line on
Sanskrit.
I already used that line on Showdown Joe's podcast. I said that must have been contraband. I mean, how did she get her hands on it?
It was written on a scroll in the blood. The blood of, I don't know.
Let's ask Vinny. Vinny is very critical of Brazil. We'll ask him if they have books there.
I'm pretty sure they do have books, but I don't think the Ronda Rousey autobiography is one of them. You know, one of the big things is everybody just assumes right off the bat that Betch knows about what happened with Ronda Rousey's dad. And I saw some reporters and stuff online, you know, engaged in conversations with other people and saying, "Oh, of course she knew. Everybody knows." And I just think to myself, I don't know that shit. I'm not out there researching Ronda Rousey's life. You know, what she does in the cage is great. You know, I keep up with her as far as a personality, but I'm not going out and researching her personal life history and her background. To me, my guess is that, you know, some sort of PR or management team fed Betch a couple lines, you know, based on what they had read from the book and about Ronda Rousey being a little mentally weak, and Betch kind of clued in on that. And my guess is that she probably really didn't know about the suicide thing. It's not like she said, you know, like, "I hope she doesn't go out there and commit suicide like family members did in the past," or anything like that. She didn't mention her dad at all. It was an offhand comment about Ronda Rousey being mentally weak. And I think people just, you know, kind of assume the worst, which, you know, hopefully it wasn't meant that way, and it was meant in the best possible way, I guess I could say.
So you brought up the article by Guilherme Cruz, and that article was the one where Betch denied any knowledge of Ronda's father's suicide?
The situation was that, yeah, basically there's no way that Betch probably read the book because the book's not available in Portuguese or in Brazil, so...
But, you know, Tom, I have a difficult time believing that she didn't know about it. I mean, UFC has put that story over so many times, and Betch has been obsessed with Ronda, you know, going after her teammates who can't fight a lick.
Yeah. You know, okay, well, on a different note, like, or it's, I guess it's on the same note, but on the flip side, I'm a pretty big MMA fan, and this is not something that's, like, flying at the top of my radar is Ronda Rousey's her father's past. So, you know, it's very plausible that Betch didn't know. But in any case, I mean, okay, here's the thing. If Ronda's going to get upset about that, okay, she made a comment about Betch coming to Jesus and having a coming to Jesus moment. And from my history, you know, these Brazilian people are pretty – they take Jesus pretty damn serious.
For sure.
So when you start mentioning stuff like that, that could be viewed as a personal insult to Betch right off the bat.
I agree with you. That could definitely be an insult.
Yeah, and another thing too here. Okay, if that's the case, and say Betch did know about this and made the comment, it's terrible thing. But you can't go through your entire life living and hating everybody that makes any joke about suicide. You know, obviously if it's directed directly at you in a personal situation, that's one thing. But there's a lot of things, like people get very mad about people making jokes about suicide or abortion or any number of other topics. And it seems like people are just, you know, kind of looking for something to be upset about.
That reminds, you know, George Carlin did a thing on suicide, and people got all upset at him. He was making a joke, and I guess it was after that very famous writer Hunter Thompson had committed suicide.
Yeah,
and I guess he was making a joke saying, you know, like, of all the people to commit suicide, a writer. I mean, imagine the process to put out the suicide note. First, you have a rough draft, then you have a first draft, then a second draft, the final draft. His point was, it's a very time consuming process. You know, for a writer, and the way George said it, it was funny. You know, it was you can joke about it, but it seemed like a lot of media was taking offense that even if Betch didn't know about Rhonda's father, that this subject matter was even broached or brought into the conversation. Do you think it should be something that's off limits? I mean,
oh, are you kidding me? Like, what? We're just gonna take everything off limits then at that. You know, Brian, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
You ever made a drunk driving joke?
Sure.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You're talking to a guy right now who has a sister who passed away because of a drunk driving incident.
Oh,
I don't go around attacking everybody that makes a drunk driving joke because I make them too. I mean, it's part of life. You know, these things happen. There's nothing you can do about it. You can try to remember, you can try to move on, you can try to do your best, but you know, there's always going to be bad things that happens in everybody's lives, whether it's tragedy, whether it's, you know, losing a loved one, losing a job, you know. And if you just take away anybody's ability to speak on these different topics, then, I mean, what the hell are you doing in your life? I mean, you're just sitting there being angry all the time. It's not worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's also interesting is I haven't seen one media member say, you know, maybe she offended her religion, you know, with the Jesus thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if somebody came out and said, you know, said something about Allah, I mean, there's going to be a huge uproar about that, you know, but it seems like, maybe it's just because maybe Rhonda doesn't understand the different, intricacies when it comes to, how religion is viewed in other countries and you know, how the customs are. And, you know, she made an offhand comment too, because, you know, people who are severely religious would take that comment as being, you know, really offensive.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, one of the things I think that Betch did wrong was she apologized. Like, she said, I didn't know, but I apologize. And one of the things even if you step over that line to deny that you knew, that's one thing. I mean, that's probably a smart thing. Don't apologize. I mean, that's, you got to stick to the gimmick.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think apologizing was probably the right thing to do. But in a way, it probably brought a lot of unneeded attention to the situation that may not have been there if she would have just not addressed it, you know, kind of let it slide by.
Yeah, and look, I mean, she did a good thing, right? I mean, we just spent 10 or 12 minutes talking about these two that I mean, I think it's going to be a walkover. It's going to be such an easy fight for Rhonda. I mean, who has Betch been in there against?
Queen of Spades, Shayna Baszler. I believe, would she beat Jessamyn Duke as well, I believe?
Yeah, and I didn't see the fight, but a lot of people are telling me that Julie Ketsey actually beat her. It was a split decision win for Betch, but they thought Julie Ketsey won.
Yeah.
So this is not going to be a good fight. I mean, I guess maybe the only thing that Betch is trying to do here is try to goad her into maybe standing with her. And I don't even know if that works to her advantage. You know, cuz
yeah, I think I think Betch's best case would be Rhonda, you know, charging at her and being able to counter-strike. So obviously in the past we've seen anybody that tries to move forward and engage with Ronda usually gets thrown.
Yep.
So, you know, obviously Betch is going to be looking to strike. She's not going to be looking to grapple with her. So I think maybe she'll sit back a little bit more. I don't think we'll see like another 20-second fight and another 20-second win on a Ronda. I think it'll go a little bit longer, but I think she's going to come out really aggressive, and that's probably what Betch wants. She probably wants her to be overly aggressive and look to capitalize on it.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, UFC 190 in Rio, it's August 1st. I mean, I don't even know any other fight on that card. And, you know, Ronda fights really don't interest me. You know, if you can armbar somebody in 14 seconds, I mean, that's great. I'll sing your praises and say you're really great at what you do. But to me, that's not entertainment. I don't get any enjoyment out of it.
None? Nothing, huh?
Well, did you want to see somebody get armbarred in 14 seconds? Or how about Alexis Davis get thrown and then... and then gets knocked out on the throw in what? What was that, 20 seconds?
Yeah, but these are all adding to Ronda's highlights and Ronda's mystique and, you know, just building her up for the future. I mean, even if you don't like it, it's a memorable moment, right? I mean, we're still talking about it now. So, you know, that goes a long way in a lot of people's minds. Not everybody's out there looking to see the fight of the night every time, Brian. You know, a lot of people like to see people just get the shit beat out of them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what they're going to get with Ronda. So I think that's where a lot of her appeal comes from.
But I would like to know if Betch was made, if they forced her to apologize, because I didn't see anything from anybody saying, well, wait a minute, let's look at this. Maybe Betch was offended first. You know, Rhonda's the golden girl. Nobody can say anything about her negative, or else you'll get a call real quick from the UFC. So I'd like to know, you know, how that came about, but I doubt we'll hear about it. Too much. But, you know, on a lighter note, the great Virgil is now on Twitter. It's the_Real_Virgil on Twitter. Tom, are you following Virgil?
Not on Twitter.
But where would you follow? What is he, MySpace or?
I don't know. You know, I thought he was still running errands for Ted DiBiase.
I mean, okay, so here's the thing. It costs $50 to talk to him for a half hour, but for $75, you can talk to him for a full hour.
Yeah.
And Tom and I were talking off the air, and I think we were in agreement that I don't think we could come up with enough material for an hour.
Yeah, I think a half hour would be great, and that would probably be more than all we need. To be honest, I don't know that he'll make it through a half hour either. I have a feeling that this would be a monetary transaction, and then we'd get about three questions. I'd ask him about Kevin Nash elbowing him as hard as he could at the Royal Rumble in Providence in the mid-90s, and that would probably be the end of it.
Or in classic Virgil fashion, you know, he'd do the interview maybe for like 12 or 15 minutes, and then he'd start hustling us for more money. Like, wait, yeah. Virgil, you agreed to a half hour.
Yeah, like, no. He might try to charge us to get an interview with Vincent as well from the NWO.
But like, even when I was like communicating with him a little bit, he's like, "Brother, Ted and I were a big deal back in the day, man. Make a lot of money." And I'm like, I didn't want to like, you know, tear into him because I'd actually like to talk to him for a little bit. But I was like, you know, Virgil, I mean, you mean Ted DiBiase was a big deal? I mean, yeah. you were a bum.
Yeah. And now he did a great job kicking that the soccer ball out of the kid's hand. Or was that DiBiase that actually did that?
Oh, with the basketball? Like if they could dribble the basketball.
The basketball, not the soccer.
Yeah, ball. If you dribble it like X amount of times, he'd give you a $100 bill. And then at the last one, he'd kick it or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the gimmick.
Yeah. So anyway, follow Virgil on Twitter and tell him to come on the show. And you know, well, hopefully we'll do it. I mean, I would certainly be willing to put up the money. I mean, to talk to Virgil. I mean, that would be something for the ages. Something people around the globe would tune in to listen to. Because I think we would challenge him too. I mean, there's some things that Virgil does that I don't think are, you know, on the up and up. And I think there's a reason why the Iron Sheik has such a distaste for Virgil.
Yeah, yeah, and that's kind of the reason why I think that the interview probably wouldn't last too long, Brian. I don't know. You're not known as a guy that's too politically correct, so I could see you and Virgil kind of butting heads for a little bit, which would be unfortunate because he would probably win that headbutt battle.
You know, I don't know if I told you this story, but I got a friend. He's Kevin Roberts. He's an assistant coach for wrestling at Oregon State University. And they went to WrestleMania in New Orleans, and he was meeting up with his brother Andy, and they were in Atlanta, and they were, you know, connecting to get to New Orleans, and Virgil was hustling them to so that he could crash in their hotel room.
What could he possibly offer? What was the,
you know, he wanted to sign some autographs, but I mean, Virgil didn't even have a seat. He was flying standby on Delta because he had some friend that would always get Virgil on the plane. Yeah. And I don't think that friend works for the airline no more, so that's why he wasn't at WrestleMania. He couldn't afford the plane ticket.
Oh, my God.
So he's trying to hustle fans that he just met for a hotel room.
Now you said he was offering to sign autographs. Was he going to sign them as someone else so that there was some value? Or no?
I assume it was just going to be Virgil.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, but just want to finish off today a little bit about your thoughts about Total Nonstop Action Wrestling, or TNA Wrestling, literally the worst name for wrestling promotion probably ever. But in short, Dave Meltzer reported that effective September 1st, they would no longer be on Destination America channel owned by Discovery Communications. And then it came out couple days ago that Ring of Honor will now come on right before TNA, and then it's going to be on right after TNA. So what do you think's going on there?
Well, from the sound of it, it looks like this deal was kind of in play for a while, regardless of whatever was happening with TNA. And I think it's – I wouldn't say like a desperation move, but – let's be honest, Destination America is not exactly killing it when it comes to ratings, okay? And the big issue with pro wrestling across the board is ad revenue that they can get. And, you know, TNA was on the – I don't know if you read the memo that was sent out from Destination America, but basically they said that taking TNA off and not renewing their contract would free up space for – it's like American Tales or something will be the Friday night, theme, and it'll be like spooky tales and stories from America. Okay, so that's what's going to end up happening. Now that TNA is being moved to Wednesday, the Friday night will be American Tales. Okay, TNA will be on Wednesday night from 9 to 11. Ring of Honor will be on before and after that. And you know, personally, I'm hoping that this wrestling block makes both products more viewable and boosts their popularity, because the more wrestling that's out there competing, even if it's not competing with the WWE, but competing for the number two spot, means more jobs, more exposure, and hopefully they can kind of turn around the view that advertisers have of pro wrestling fans being scumbags, you know, by getting some good ratings on Wednesday night.
Yeah, I was really happy to hear about Ring of Honor going on Destination America, because I get the channel, but you know, I'm not in a Sinclair broadcasting market, so I don't see their syndicated show. So I have to like go on some kind of torrent site if I want to watch their TV show, or one of those tube sites or whatever. So I thought it was cool that now I can just put it on my DVR. And I think it's a great deal for Ring of Honor, because they're already producing this show, and I guess they're somewhat profitable already. So now all they're doing is saying, Destination America, you can replay this show. It's no added production cost for Ring of Honor. It's just another revenue stream and exposure for them. Whereas you look at TNA, I mean, they got to pay Jeff Hardy. They got to pay Kurt Angle, Bobby Roode, all these guys that make considerable money. So they have to put the production together and then put it on TV, put it on Destination America, where Ring of Honor, they can survive even without Destination America. TNA without Destination America doesn't exist.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I'd go that far because, you know, when TNA was coming off a spike, there were it's been reported that there were other companies that they were talking to, and some of those had, I don't know exactly which ones, but they had more viewership and more clearance in homes than Destination America does. So there are people out there who are willing to at least take a look at wrestling programming, and it still does bring in very high ratings compared to average, you know, average cable programs. So you always have that in its favor. But, you know, the biggest thing is just really it's a perception of the fans when it comes to companies that are willing to advertise. If, you know, maybe it's true and wrestling fans just will not spend money on products that are being advertised during wrestling shows. That could be the case, and there could be nothing that could be done to change it in advertisers' minds. Or, you know, perhaps with Ring of Honor coming on board, Ring of Honor's looked at, I think, a little bit more seriously and not as, you know, it's not as trashy sometimes as TNA or WWE is looked upon. And, you know, perhaps that'll, you know, sway the advertisers a little bit. But, you know, I don't know. I just hope that it works out good. I hope Lucha Underground gets a better deal. I hope Paragon Pro or whatever's on the old TV cable guide network does well. And I hope GFW does well because, you know, in a few years, I'm probably going to be looking for a job.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to Chael about Global Force, and he was mentioning that there is no TV deal currently. And even if there's not a TV deal by the first taping July 24th at the Orleans in Vegas, they're going to record it anyway. And then they're just going to use that as a pilot and then continue to shop it to networks and see if they can get a deal from there. But the first taping on the 24th at the Orleans will be 4 hours. It'll be four shows, and that's kind of like the pilot, and they're hoping to get picked up by somebody, you know, really as soon as possible, but they're ready to gamble the money and record without a TV deal and, worst case, throw it on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, Jarrett, you know, he's been involved in these kind of like splinter projects where they're trying things out. Obviously, he was there at the beginning of, you know, TNA, you know, when it was running pay-per-views and stuff with no TV. So he's not adverse to experimenting when it comes to some of these things. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens with Global Force Wrestling. I don't know if they'll end up with a decent TV deal or if they'll be shopping for a while in this whole thing will never come to fruition. But, you know, in the past, he was linked to Toby Keith and CMT. And he does, you know, he does have some connections, you know, in that part of the country. So hopefully they pay off and there's more wrestling on TV.
Sure. Now, Ring of Honor, do you think they're going to have to upgrade the production values for Destination America? Because some of their – where they record, like, the lights are really blinding and, you know, it can be rough sometimes.
No, I think it'll – you know, obviously I think it's just going to be the same show, just repackaged and put on Destination America. I don't think you're going to see any, you know, huge differences in the production value. But, you know, I could be wrong. They could look at this as another big step. Another thing, too, is that – they've also got a deal with NESN, the New England Sports Network.
Oh, yeah, the Red Sox channel, right?
Oh, yeah, baby. So, you know, they'll be getting those viewerships or more viewers in the Northeast market, which is a huge deal because they do you know, there's a lot of indie wrestling up in this area of the country, and there are a lot of indie wrestlers from this area, you know. Right in the town, literally in the town where I'm at right now. Ring of Honor talent, Brutal Bob Evans, is somewhere very close by, along with, you know, I know Mike Bennett and I believe Maria Kanellis are up in this area as well. And there's just, you know, a plethora of guys on the indie scene and even in ROH who are from this area. So I think that'll be really good for them, this deal on NESN, because it'll help them get a bigger stronghold in this area. And with a lot of local guys, you know, it could lead to some good house show attendance.
Yeah, where do they run house shows? Revere?
I'm not. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't think they've been running in the market for a little bit because of that. But I know that, you know, a lot of these guys that are showing up on other indie shows, like some of the Evolve shows, Beyond Wrestling, run a lot of shows in Providence and stuff. So regardless of Ring of Honor's here or not, there are a lot of indie guys floating around. And, you know, with more shows being on television, more opportunities open up. If the crowds are bigger, there's more money to go around. So it can only be a good thing in the long run, I think.
Yeah, and I wonder if Ring of Honor is part of – you know, I assume TNA on September 1st, they're going to be gone from Destination America, and it's just going to be Ring of Honor. I wonder if there's an opportunity for them for some shoulder programming, because they own that entire tape library, if I'm not mistaken. They haven't sold it to anybody, right?
You're talking about
Ring of Honor.
Oh, no. I think they own – I mean, they own all their entire library.
Can you imagine – can you imagine the best of shows that they could put on there with Bryan Danielson, CM Punk, Samoa Joe, you know, like all these guys that Kevin Steen or Kevin Owens, all these guys that become, you know, international stars, they have tape on.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the only thing that might, I mean, there are a few things that could, you know, throw a monkey wrench in those plans. Like, I know that Ring of Honor was running shows on HDNet, or what is now Access TV, and I wonder what the situation is with getting footage from those shows, because, you know, some of those shows are pretty damn good, and I think that it was around a time where, you know, some of those guys that people know now were performing in Ring of Honor, so, you know, some of the guys who are on the WWE roster now were in Ring of Honor then, so it'd be good exposure and kind of, you know, build up the level of Ring of Honor in a way to fans. But I don't know what the situation is with that tape or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a good time to be a wrestling fan. No shortage of content out there to watch, maybe even too much.
Did you watch Lucha Underground this week?
No. I mean, I'm hoping to, what do they call that? Binge watch. I'm hoping to binge watch one of these weekends. Hopefully they'll release it on Blu-ray or something.
Yeah, this past week's show was awesome. If you're gonna watch one, this would be a really good one. The whole thing from pretty much beginning to end was great. The thing you got to realize when you're watching it is basically you're watching a television show built around like sci-fi action, which happens to take place in the ring. So some of the outside character development may seem a little bit extreme when it comes to professional wrestling, but the overall package is pretty damn good. And you know, without giving away too many spoilers, even though the show's a few days old, the main event of this past show was a death match. And you know, they don't take those words too lightly when they say death match. It's pretty much as advertised.
It's a fight to the death.
Hey, yeah, they're not screwing around.
Wow.
I'll tell you that much. Check it out.
Lucha Underground on the El Rey Network.
Yeah, and I believe that – I know I had seen on Twitter that they had posted up the last match that took place on that show, which I believe was only about 7 or 8 minutes long, but it's definitely worth a look. Great match between Mil Muertes and Phoenix.
All right. Okay, check that out. I'll be sure to check that out myself. And so we got Alves and Condit tonight. We got Elimination Chamber tomorrow. That should be interesting. Kevin Steen or Kevin Owens fighting John Cena.
Yep. Yeah, that'll be a good one, especially now that Owens will be moving up to the main roster. It kind of leaves things a little more open-ended. If Owens was just coming up and taking on Cena in kind of a one-off, I would be looking for Cena to, you know, somehow pull out the victory. But the fact that Kevin Owens has been confirmed to be on TV pretty much from here on out as a part of the main roster makes me wonder if, you know, maybe he's just going to beat the living crap out of Cena and continue on this role that he's on.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to that. That's tomorrow night on the WWE Network. All right, Tom, that's enough for this week. We'll I guess we'll maybe do something during the week or just next weekend. I guess whatever's good with your schedule.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll figure it out. Hey, before we go, you got a pick for the main event tonight?
I'm going to go with Condit.
Yeah. I would say the same. You know, hopefully he's not in too bad of shape coming off of this long layoff from the injury. But to me, you know, in the past couple of years,
you know, Alves hasn't been super active, so I don't think it'll be a huge problem when it comes to ring rust.
Yeah, I think Alves, you know, he might only be like 30 or 31, but I think he's got a lot of years on that body. And, you know, he had that issue with his brain that thankfully they caught before it became a major yep. issue. And just seems to have, ever since that UFC 100 card, just seems to have never really performed at the level that he did. You know, and it wasn't like it was a horrendous beatdown that GSP gave him. I mean, he beat him easily, but it wasn't like he got killed. But ever since then, just kind of been like a downward trend for him in his career.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that whole the whole brain situation really set him back. And you know, it's crazy to see somebody even come back from something that's that serious. So you know, more power to the guy. But unfortunately, yeah, he hasn't been sniffing at a title shot since that UFC 100 fight, which is really unfortunate, because for a while he looked like he was a world beater. You know, he was killing guys left and right.
He was fighter of the year in 2008 by many outlets.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, he was a hell of a run, but yeah, I think Condit will pull it out. Condit's great.
Yeah, it's good to see him back. He always puts on good fights, and you know, hopefully they don't match him, you know, too much with the wrestlers, because he could be pretty exciting in a, you know, a stand up or kickboxing type centric matchup. Mm-hmm. All right, guys. So that's the Filthy FRB show for Saturday, May 30th, and we'll talk to you guys soon. Thanks.
Peace.